Imagine sleeping in the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's iconic sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code Odyssey. So head to B-O-L-L and Branch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
What's up, fam? This is Jay, letting you know that Push Black has a new podcast called State of Criminal Justice. Every week, State of Criminal Justice digs into the most important events happening right now in the legal system. Listen, the future of our community depends on us understanding how injustice systematically operates in this country. State of Criminal Justice is here to ensure you're always up to date on how institutional racism is impacting Black people nationwide. State of Criminal Justice is produced by Push Black. You can catch it on our Push Black YouTube channel, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere you listen to podcasts. Thanks for the support. Peace. What's up, fam? This is Jay from Push Black, and today we're wrapping up Season 4 of Black History Year. Yeah, I can't believe it myself. It is already that time. But in 12 episodes, we've tackled a lot. We've covered what reclaiming our race histories might take. We've talked about escaping the plantation and the power of our words. And we've begun the work of unlearning myths about ourselves, our community, our culture, and our future. So we thank you for showing up and continuing to do and support the work. And we thank those who've come before us, those who've paved the way, like today's guests. I'm Jay from Push Black, and you're listening to Black History Year. Activists from past movements fought the good fight against oppression to empower our people. Abolitionists, freedom fighters, artists, musicians, all of them struggled for liberation. But here's another myth we gotta bust, y'all. For some reason, a lot of us believe their fight stopped when a movement ended, that they retired or have even passed beyond the veil. That ain't the truth. Because many of these brothers and sisters are still alive and they're still fighting. I'm gonna sit down today with one of these brothers, Robert Lee Johnson. Mr. Johnson is a best-selling author and former Black Panther who served as a leading member of the party's Compton branch. In the 1970s, Johnson was a founding member of the Coalition Against Police Abuse, and more recently serves as a founding member of the Compton 125 Historical Society. And you also might have seen him in the 2016 documentary, The Streets of Compton. Look, I could go on and on about the incredible work that this brother's been doing for decades, but just know he's about to lay down some wisdom that'll help us move the needle forward. But first, ahead of this amazing interview, we'll hear the story of a man whose life ended too soon, but whose far-reaching legacy lives on.
Racial tensions were high in the 1960s. The government's repugnance for the Black Panther Party was deeply rooted in what they feared the most. Black militancy, Black self-defense, and organizing against police corruption. Conservatives fully backed gun control when it was Black men and women toting rifles and flexing their constitutional rights. And they figured the only way to shut down the party was to kill its leader. As the Chicago Police Department and FBI raided the Black Panther's safe house in 1969, Aquia and Jerry jumped on top of her fiancé, shielding him from any bullets. She protected him from what she feared the most. Every single day. His death. Him being a target, a martyr, an ancestor too early. The door burst open and in stormed men in battle gear. After quickly killing the Black Panther's lookout, one man headed directly for the back bedroom. His white hand, opposite his machine gun, violently grabbed Aquia's perfectly coiffed fro and dragged her to the living room. From inside the bedroom, she heard a man identify her fiancé, the love of her life, Fred Hampton. The sound of the last two gunshots pierced the air, and the quietness that followed was deafening. The man turned to Aquia. With the gun pressed firmly to her pregnant belly, no tears crept down Aquia's face. Instead, she remained stoic and found solace in her bravery. Her survivor's guilt would not devour her. She had to continue the work. Along with preserving Fred Hampton's childhood home as a safe space for community organizing and education classes, and Jerry coached young actress Dominique Fishback on how to portray her in The Black Messiah, a film about the days leading up to Hampton's death. But Jerry isn't alone. Many other Black Panthers are still here, still alive, and still fighting.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
What does Black liberation look like to you?
Self-determination, self-definition, the ability to define phenomena in our community and have that phenomena act in a way that works in our favor.
And how does your work contribute toward that vision of Black liberation?
You know, I tend to try my best to inform our community. So I write books on local history. I try to plug the holes that have been left by, you know, the history that you receive in high school. For instance, I live in California. It wasn't until I was an adult that I knew anything about the last governor under Mexican rule who was a Black man. You know, so you don't hear too much about Black people being governors or this or that, but here in California, we've had a Black governor. It's just that he was under Mexican rule, and that was Don Pio Pico. Now, most of us in the Black community, most of our lives have driven up and down Pico Boulevard and had no idea that it was named for a Black man. Society overall tries to make it seem like, yes, okay, there was repression against Black people. You had segregation and everything. But if it wasn't for good white people, you would still be in that situation. So I write about Black heroes. I try not to just wallow in tragedy, but also show our victories. I try to raise that contradiction in education. The duty of a revolutionary is to raise or heighten the contradiction. So every chance we get, we try to raise the contradiction between the ideals that the society puts forward and the reality. So it's a matter of breaking through the illusion of freedom or of independence and actually look at the reality of our situation. We have to make a correct analysis of our concrete situation. And with all the distractions that are involved with society, from video games to, you know, all the entertainment, just to distract us from, you know, what's really going on in our lives and how things around the world affect us, you find that more people have their attention into things that don't even exist, rather than looking at situations that affect us directly. So we try to point people in a direction to where they're looking at their concrete reality and not being distracted, and then try to give them tools to act.
So, Mr. Johnson, when you were coming up in California, did your family or your community emphasize local Black history in the ways that you have, you know, come to emphasize it?
I grew up in the city of Compton, and I grew up there at a very unique time, because, as you know, Compton was the city where we had the first Black mayor of a major municipality west of the Mississippi. Okay. Not only did he have that, but when our mayor was Mayor Douglas Dollarhide, and actually he was a son of a slave, but he also walked into office with a majority Black city council and school board. So in Compton, we had a unique situation. So after learning about the Tuskegee Airmen while I was a student at Benjamin O. Davis Junior High School, we went on a field trip to the Dominguez Adobe, where we were able to learn about the Spanish occupation of California, and then eventually the Mexican occupation of California. And as I mentioned, the last governor under Mexican rule, which was Pio Pico, and the last military leader under Mexican rule, which was his brother, Andreas Pico. So one of the things we're not told about is that during the American conquest, the two leading members of California, the governor and the commander of the military, were both men of African descent. So that's when I started noticing that a lot of history is just left out. We're given this narrative that very rarely includes us, when in fact, we're all over the place.
So when you were coming up and you realized that part of history, that we're all over the place, that we have engaged in multiple aspects of history since the beginning of time, essentially, how did that change your outlook as a young person? And what did you do next?
Well, the city I was living in, Compton, was in a transition. But once I realized that I was being lied to about something basic like history, it made me curious about what else was going on that I wasn't being adequately informed about. And then I started wondering why. So, I became a little more involved with reading news and trying to find out more about history. Right about that same time, there had been a robbery, and from what they told us, the police were chasing these guys in a car. The car wrecked. You know, they hit a pole and the guys kind of scrambled out and they started running. You know how kids in the neighborhood do, you see something going on, you kind of run towards it. Well, we ran towards it just in time to see, this one guy was running and he's knocking on all these doors. He's trying to get away, but there's a bunch of houses. He's knocking on the doors and the cop just got down on one knee and shot him in the back. And I don't remember him being armed or anything like that. So that was like, okay. And then within the next 6 months, the Los Angeles County Sheriff's had basically shot a 13-year-old girl in the head around the corner from me. She was the younger sister of a couple of some friends of mine, the Faust family. And Marquita Faust was shot in the head by the sheriff while they were brutalizing her mother. So that actually got me more involved politically. Matter of fact, that's when I first became involved with the Black Panther Party.
Hmm. Tell me about that. How did you become involved after you became more politicized?
When Marquita was killed, they had actually arrested her mother, charged her with murder. It was members of the Black Panther Party who had come out and organized the community. I mean, they went door to door asking if people knew what had happened and announced there was a meeting at the house that night. So, you know, place was packed. Everybody was there. And they basically, because people had no idea what to do, but you had people who were able to kind of say, this is what we need to do as a neighborhood or as a community. And the first thing was to get Mrs. Faust out of jail. So, you know, I was impressed. You know, here it wasn't just people talking about doing something, but people doing something. And at that time, the breakfast program was going. So some friends of mine, we volunteered as community workers for the breakfast program. Now, Black Panther Party believed in theory and practice. You know, today you have these guys walking around and some of them like to dress up in berets and carry on, and they have a lot of rhetoric. But where's their practice? And I don't mean showing up at some rally with a bunch of shotguns. What I'm saying, what are you doing every day in the community to raise that contradiction? With the breakfast program, the Black Panther Party was able to show that in America, richest country on the planet, Black children were going to school hungry. And it embarrassed the government to the point where they expanded their breakfast program into the schools to counter what we were doing.
What was that like as you actually began to get engaged and join up with the program?
Now, the reason why that program was so successful, which a lot of people don't understand, was that the goal of the breakfast program wasn't just to feed children. It was to bring the community together, because what started happening was that mothers and fathers of the children that we were feeding, of course, wanted to make that program work. So they started participating. They got to know each other. And what we realized was that the successful breakfast program wasn't one that was run by the Black Panther Party, but what the ones that were taken over by the community, and they started running it themselves. Because the idea is to show what we can do together when we act in unity. Maybe one of us can't, you know, has problems because we've got to work and everything where the kid doesn't get food. But you know what? If we all act together, we can feed all of our children. So people got that. You know, you didn't have to say, well, this is socialism or anything like that. No, people said, this is the breakfast program, and I'm for that. So we expanded those things. In Compton, we had the Compton Neighborhood Tutorial Program, where we worked with kids in tutoring in math and reading and history. So what did we want to do that for? Well, we wanted to show that there was gaps in the education system, but we also had college students come off of Cal State Dominguez Hills and Cal State Long Beach under a program that worked in those days called the EPIC program. So the students got 3 units to tutor, and the kids had college students tutoring them. So we set that program on a track so that the people start to run that program. That was the idea. That was why the Black Panther Party would run community survival programs. It was an organizing tool as well as a survival tool for the community.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
How did your parents react to you getting engaged in the actions that were taking place?
Like most parents, they saw the news and they were not happy because they were worried about me. My stepfather used to just basically just lay it out. He said, look, you complain about the police killing people or jailing people, but they're about staying in power. And so the reality is that they're going to do whatever they can to stay in power. That means killing you or arresting you. But that, and that's one good thing about youth. You know, you have that little hubris where you think, oh, it's not going to be me. You know, you get to the point where all the things against me are daunting, then you end up not doing anything. You know, I mean, in life, there are risks. And, you know, there's a reason why they recruit 18-year-olds into the Army and not 45-year-olds.
You know, at this point, what was changing in you as you became more involved with the work that the Panthers were doing?
Well, you know, as you're getting older and you're starting to see what really has to be done, that this it wasn't something frivolous. I met some of the most serious men and women I've ever met in my life while I was in Black Panther Party. Very strategic, very open to the community, but strategic and very realistic. There's an idea out there or a stereotype of a Black revolutionary that's just a bomb thrower and just, you know, undisciplined and kind of wild out there, you know, just, you know, waving guns at people. And that was not true of the Black Panther Party at all. Black Panther Party was extremely specific in what it was doing, especially when Elaine Brown became the chair of the party. Elaine mapped out basically a strategy that worked very well in Oakland and then wanted to use Oakland as a template for other places.
You know, I think that most people associate the Panthers with Brother Huey Newton and that initial group. But there were, I think, different periods of leadership that we don't hear about too often in the history books, like with Sister Elaine Brown. So when you joined the party, what was happening in terms of leadership?
Well, in the early 70s, which is about the time that I joined the party was changing tactics because of the heavy losses that had been taken earlier. You know, the raids on the offices, the destruction of medical supplies and food for the breakfast program was a routine thing. The arrests, and of course, I'm sure you're aware of the assassinations just across the country, but specifically in Los Angeles. Los Angeles and Chicago, I think, were the two chapters that had the most party members killed by law enforcement. So people were very aware that this was a life and death endeavor and acted accordingly. But what Elaine saw was that the rhetoric needed to be tempered with action. And the action was to take control of the local municipality, to form a base that we could use and develop resources from. And she was the genius at that. You know, the Oakland Community School, the George Jackson Medical Clinic in Berkeley, you know, and then the like programs across the country. You know, the medical clinic from the Seattle chapter is still open to this day. So, like I said, these programs weren't just goody two shoes. I'm trying to do something I'm gonna feed your kid or for a day. These programs were developed so that the party could organize around the issues and unify the community behind the issues that the programs were bringing out.
What were some of the challenges to getting the community to engage with this strategy that you're describing?
Well, actually, a lot of people could relate to that strategy. Unfortunately, in Compton, most of that leadership that I was telling you about, that Douglas Dollarhide and people like Maxie Filer and other Black luminaries out of Compton, they were oriented by the NAACP. Most of them had come out of, especially in the late 50s and early 60s, had come out of the NAACP, and their movement was more of a middle-class inclusion. They didn't make an analysis that the system or the institutions were racist and needed to be changed. They wanted to become a part of those institutions and show that they could competently run a city. For instance, in the mid 70s, we ran Lionel Wilson for mayor of Oakland. Matter of fact, I'm glad I was able to work in two political campaigns. I worked in Douglas Dollarhide's campaign in Compton in 1969, and I worked in Lionel Wilson's campaign, and he became the first Black mayor of Oakland. But the party was able to become most effective during that time and under the leadership of Elaine Brown. We were able to have more of a sway with the city in an effort to get jobs in the community. You know, we had Panthers on the Port Commission. You know, we had Panthers appointed to different commissions and making those institutions more responsive to people, and then trying to think of creative ways to uplift our community by using those resources. For instance, Erica Huggins was on the Alameda Board of Education. So what she was able to do was to raise the contradiction of the education of the incarcerated youth, which was basically none, but no one had ever paid attention to it.
So at this point, members of the community, were they more open to the revolutionary approach, or were they more open to the middle-class inclusion approach that you were mentioning?
Well, it depends on what community you were in. Unfortunately, in Compton, we were dealing with the with that middle-class assimilation type of program. You know, the people who were elected at that time basically wanted to show that Black people could competently run a city. That was their main goal. You know, our goal was a little more ambitious, that we could actually recreate a vision of what a city should look like and how it should serve its constituents. And some of it was generational, you know? So for instance, the Black administration in Compton was not necessarily opposed to us. They just had their own, how would you say, their own agenda. Now in Oakland, it was different. You know, of course, Oakland was the base of the party. And their idea was to actually recreate a vision of what a city should be and how it should serve its people. And of course, we had a huge backlash there. I have, Jay, I'll just tell you my personal theory, because we also, a lot of people remember, we brought Huey Newton back, Dr. Newton back from Cuba. I believe, you know, whenever you look at Paul Robeson, and the things that happened to Paul Robeson, how he became almost agoraphobic. But he had suffered from delusions and anxieties, which caused him not to be able to travel. Now, Paul Robeson never denounced his politics or anything like that. It's just all of a sudden he had issues where he could barely get out of the house, which was ironic because the United States was trying to keep him from traveling around the world because they didn't like what he was saying about America. I believe that looking at this program called MK Ultra, which was a CIA administered program that used drugs to change behavior. If you read about Paul Robeson and his illnesses, you know, his son would even say, you know, I think my dad's been drugged. But if you look at the symptoms, it sounds like a bad acid trip. I believe something similar happened to Dr. Newton. You know, a lot of people were aware that he was self-medicating, but people forget it was, you know, he was probably self-medicating before when he was in prison because he had been shot in the abdomen and was in pain, you know. So I believe that that issue was taken advantage of.
Give us a summary, actually, of the MK Ultra program.
MK Ultra was a program by the CIA. What they were trying to do was experiment with different psychedelic drugs to see how it would affect people, or if they could actually modify behavior with it. There was a 60 Minutes program where this was done years ago, where they interviewed a Black soldier who had been in Berlin at the time when there was the Berlin Wall and everything. I think he was there either in the late 50s or early 60s. He was kidnapped off the street, tied up, basically tossed into a basement and interrogated. And while he was being interrogated, they gave him massive doses of LSD. And they wanted to see how he would react to being interrogated. Would he give up any secrets? What would happen? They never told him what they had done. You know, he never really understood what happened until later when it came on 60 Minutes. This was part of the MK Ultra program, using these psychedelics unwittingly on people. By the early 70s, the police realized that by killing Black leaders, that they were creating martyrs. And if you look at COINTELPRO, the FBI's counterintelligence program, its goal was basically to disrupt, discredit, and destroy people and organizations. That was, well, basically the best way to disrupt an organization is to basically drug your leadership, you know, which discredits them and eventually destroys them. By the late 1970s, just about every major figure in the Black liberation movement had a cocaine issue. That wasn't accidental. And this is before the flood of cocaine that comes from Iran-Contra, you know, where places like Compton and South Central are flooded by basically government cocaine. And that gives me, and that's the other part to this story. The other thing that the government realized was that they had to change the culture on the street. You know, during that time, the culture on the street was a national, a Black nationalistic culture, you know, more of a revolutionary activist culture. That was changed by using media, especially the movies, the so-called Black exploitation movies, to change the culture on the street from one of a revolutionary or nationalistic culture to one of a gangster culture. If you look at all these movies, Black Caesar, Superfly, all those movies basically glorify the hustler, the street hustler, the pimp, you know, the drug dealer.
And this was like mid to late 70s when these films started coming out, right?
Oh, this was the early 70s.
Early 70s, okay. Yeah. So around the same time as the, I guess, Panthers came into prominence?
Well, about the same time that the Black Panther Party had been heavily repressed. Okay. You know, we're talking about after the assassination of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, the assassinations over here in UCLA of Bunchy Carter and John Huggins, you know, the raid across the country of Panther offices and facilities, but including in December 1969, you know, the five-hour police murder raid on the Los Angeles chapter's headquarters on Central Avenue. So people saw that and said, oh man, well, you know, if you're a revolutionary, it's like you're under the gun. It might be a little easier to, you know, to just be a regular criminal. And it's starting to look good because Superfly looked like he's having fun. Okay. And you saw that transition take place. And to this day, you don't hear these kids talking about, I want to be a revolutionary. You know, what they're saying is gangster this, gangster that.
You hear that? Your dog knows. Spring is coming sooner than you think. Dog walks, dog parks, playing fetch, all the stuff your dog loves to do with you. But the warmer weather also means that fleas and ticks are coming back. Fleas and ticks are in the grass, in the woods, and even on their dog friends. Fleas are an itchy nuisance, can easily get into your home, furniture, and beds, which can be terrible. Ticks are even worse. They're hard to spot, but can carry disease and get your dog really sick. PetMeds has your furry friend protected with the best products to prevent flea and ticks all year long. PetMeds pharmacists connect directly with your vet to save you time and deliver the best products for your pet. PetMeds offers low prices on all flea and tick meds, including NexGard, Simparica, and more. And PetMeds AutoShip helps you save even more with additional discounts on regular shipments of PetMeds, dog food, and other high-quality supplies. So get ready for all the spring fun now. Visit PetMeds.com and use promo code PODCAST to save 40% on your first auto ship order. That's PetMeds.com and promo code PODCAST.
And yeah, through media is extremely powerful in telling us at least what we should prioritize. And it's interesting to hear about you describe that in, you know, in real time as you were seeing that. So, you know, as you were seeing these changes happening in society and the attacks on the movement through COINTELPRO and through potentially MKUltra, what were you involved in?
Well, I was involved in some things that I really can't mention now.
Sure, sure.
But for the most part, we were still, you know, running our survival programs. But of course, that last, how would you say, few years of the party, I didn't leave the party until 1980. But after Huey, Dr. Newton had returned, and after Elaine Brown had left, things got pretty chaotic. And that was because of the results of what the FBI had been doing for years. You know, one of the things they were able to do was now they were able to embody the Black Panther Party in one person, and that was Dr. Newton. So all they had to do then was just destroy that one person. And that's basically what happened. You know, Dr. Newton in 1982 announced that the Black Panther Party had disbanded. But even before then, even a few years before, the Black Panther Party was just existing. It was no longer operating politically. And, you know, that's why I say, you know, it's nice to see the other legacy survives, and you see all these groups wanting to emulate the Black Panther Party. But you can't call yourself the new Black Panther Party or the Black Panther Party militia or this, that, or the other without taking up the ideology of the Black Panther Party, which many of them don't even really know. You know, we talk about revolutionary intercommunalism, the idea that you know, we're all around the world, we're all communities that interact with each other. And if something happens in South Africa, that affects us here in America. You know, something happens in Palestine, that affects us here, and vice versa. So they don't have that type of ideology. Matter of fact, they've kind of twisted what they've heard without looking at what was actually real. So you can't call yourself the Black Panther Party if you don't take on even the organizing tactics, okay? We ran the breakfast programs, we ran the free food programs. You know, we ran these programs for a reason. And those reasons were to serve the people, body and soul. And by doing that, we were able to form a connection with the community, okay? Because it's not, you know, the Panthers against the police or against, you know, racism. It's our community against the police and racism. You see what I'm saying?
Absolutely. The Panthers work for the community. They're on behalf of the community and members of the community.
But it was with that understanding that, you know, we were not a separate force. You know, Huey had criticized that in the early 70s, because there was a defection in the party, And Huey basically was saying, look, you know, you run the risk of becoming revolutionary cultists. That's why he had us take off the leather jacket, take off the beret, and just go into the community and work in the community so that we did not separate ourselves. You can't organize the community from the outside. And what we were trying to do was stand as one with the community. And we have too many of these other groups who keep saying, oh, we represent the community, but they don't have a base in the community. And that's what you have to create if you're going to sustain yourself on any level. And so when I start seeing an organization that does that, I don't care what their name is, I'll know who their inspiration is. But it takes work. You know, it's not like a rally. You don't get to put on your beret and leather jacket and run around with a shotgun and think you're scaring white people, okay, who have more guns than you. You know, it's that work. It's that comrade that gets up at 4:30 in the morning to feed somebody else's kids. And keep in mind, the average age of a party member was like 17 years old, okay? What are our teenagers doing today? You know, you could join the party at 16. I lied, I was 15, but you know, I was about to be 16. But what I'm saying is, what has changed? Teenagers are the same, but what's changed to make a teenager get up in the morning to feed somebody else's kids or to go out and organize a free food program so we give away 1,000 bags of groceries so that we could expose hunger in America, you know? Or develop a tutorial program for kids.
Does our community even care anymore to the same extent that we once did? It seemed that, you know, back in the era that we're speaking about, there was more of a sense of shared destiny and a connection. But today, it seems that we are becoming more and more separated, more individualist minded, and don't necessarily see, you know, our fates tied to those of our brothers and sisters. Would you agree or disagree with that?
Oh, no, I wholeheartedly agree. You know, our opposition realized they had to change the culture on the street. See, the reason why the youth during that time got up and did these things was because, and you would hear it often, because I want to help my people. You would hear that. Why are you doing this? Because I want to help my people. Or because I'm Black. You know, you're not going to get that now because the culture on the street has been changed to just what you said, an individualistic, I got to get mine, I got to get paid, screw everybody else.
And especially seems that since, as you mentioned, the drugs were flooded into the community and the government's hand in that, you know, it's not uncommon for us to now look just at our neighbors as our primary enemy, as opposed to, I think prior to that, when, you know, it was more apparent the forces that were actually against us. So what do you think it would take to shift the mindset, shift the culture to get to a point where we can see ourselves and our communities in the light we need to in order to take a different type of collective action?
I think it's coming about now. I think that we have a new mentality that's developing. You know, I watch some of these grassroots groups like Wisdom from the Field here in Los Angeles and some other groups out here who are actually trying to do things in the community. You know, when we were doing survival programs, we went to see what would help the community now. So a breakfast program might not be needed today. Maybe it's a computer literacy program. You see what I'm saying? Maybe it's something as simple as an arts program where you bring the community together and teach kids art. Because see, any of these things actually brings people together, brings your neighbors out so that they can meet each other and know who they are and know who each other's kids are. Okay? One of the reasons why that house was so full when 13-year-old Marquita Faust was killed, you know, her, I guess he would have been a younger brother at that time, David Blake, DJ Quick was related to her. That would have been his older sister, because he would have been like a baby about that time, you know. But what happened was that as they went door to door, everybody in the community was, you know, was concerned. And they and that's why they were able to have a house full of people. And one of the reasons why Mrs. Faust was able to be let go was because there was a community outcry. You know, we were able to raise some money, but they were aware that people were outraged that this, you know, 13-year-old girl was killed by the sheriff's deputy. Okay. So you're starting to see that again with these, especially with these police outrages. You know, this has not stopped. I mean, people have been protesting police brutality since slavery, okay? You know, with the slave catchers. The idea is that the mentality is like a pendulum. It's swinging back to where people realize that the only way we get through this is in unity.
Just like that, we're at the end of this episode of Black History Year. This podcast is produced by Push Black, the nation's largest nonprofit black media company. At Push Black, we agree with Marcus Garvey when he said, "A people without knowledge of their past, history, origin, and culture is like a tree without roots." And I'm guessing you probably feel that's important too. I mean, you're here at the end of a podcast about black history. You matter. Your choice to be here matters. It lets us know that you value the work. Push Black exists because we saw we had to take matters into our own hands. And you make Push Black happen with your contributions at blackhistoryyear.com. Most people do $5 or $10 a month, but every little bit makes a difference. Appreciate you supporting the work. The Black History Year production team includes Tariq Alani, Patrick Sanders, Leslie Taylor Grover, William Anderson, Jerea Bradley, Brooke Brown, Siobhan Chapman, Tabitha Jacobs, Abani Jones, Brianna Lambeck, Courtney Morgan, Zane Murdoch, Akuyate, Tasha Taylor, and Darren Wallace. Producing the podcast, we have Sydney Smith and Sasha Kai Parker, who also edits the show. And Black History Year's executive producer is Julian Walker. And I'm Jay from Push Black. Peace.